Chapter 8. To say my arrival at the offices of Lyle and Black about an hour after lunch caused a bit of a stir would be an understatement.
"Get out of these offices!"
Gregory shouted at me almost as soon as I walked through the door on the fourth floor into the reception area. And he wasn't finished then.
"You are a disgrace to your profession and to this firm! I will not have you here contaminating the other staff!"
I had made the mistake of not sneaking in while he was at lunch. Mrs. McDowd looked positively frightened by the outburst. I probably did as well. "Gregory," I tried to say, but he advanced towards me, bunching his fists. Surely I thought he's not going to hit me. He didn't, but he grabbed me by the sleeve of my suit and dragged me towards the door. He was surprisingly strong and fit for someone whose only workout was the walk to and from the restaurant on the corner. "Leave me alone," I shouted at him, but he took no notice.
"Gregory, stop it!"
Patrick's deep voice reverberated around the reception area. Gregory stopped pulling and let go of my sleeve.
"I will not have this man in these offices," Gregory said. "He has brought the firm of Lyle and Black into disrepute."
Patrick looked at the reception desk and at Mrs. McDowd and Mrs. Johnson, who were sitting behind it.
"Let us discuss this in your office," Patrick said calmly. "Nicholas, will you please wait here?"
"Outside the door,"
Gregory said, pointing towards the lifts and not moving an inch towards his office. I stood there looking back and forth between them. Everyone in the firm knew of Gregory's temper. It was legendary. But I had rarely seen it laid bare and so raw, and at such close quarters.
"I will go out for a coffee," I said. "I'll be back in 20 minutes.
"Best to go home," Patrick said. "I'll call you later."
Gregory turned towards Patrick.
"I told you that we should never have taken him on in the first place."
"In your office, please, Gregory," Patrick said,
almost shouting. He had a pretty good temper in him, too, although it was usually slow to rise. I waited while Gregory reluctantly moved off down the corridor with Patrick. I would have adored being a fly on the wall during their discussion.
"You had better go," said Mrs. McDowd firmly. "I don't want you upsetting Mr. Gregory any more. His heart can't take it."
I looked at her. Mrs. McDowd, who saw it as her business to know everything about everyone in the firm. She probably knew Gregory's blood pressure and his heart surgeon. "Tell me, Mrs. McDowd, do you think Herb gambled much?"
"You mean on the stock market?" she asked.
"On the horses?"
"Oh, no," she said. "Mr. Herb didn't like betting on the horses. Too risky," he said. "So much better to bet on a certainty. That's what he always told me."
Death was a certainty. Benjamin Franklin had said so. Death. And taxes. I did go home, but not immediately. Before I left Hendon, I had looked up the locations of money home agents near to Lombard Street. I was amazed at how many there were, at least 30 within a 1 mile radius of my office, the nearest being just round the corner in King William Street.
"This didn't come from here," said the lady sitting behind a glass screen. "It hasn't got our stamp on it."
I had somehow expected the money home agency to be like a bank or a money exchange, but this one was right at the back of a convenience store.
"Well, can you tell me where it did come from?" I asked the lady.
"Don't you know?"
she asked. "No," I said with declining patience. "I wouldn't have asked if I knew." She looked at me through the glass, then down at the payment slip. I had brought with me one of those I had found in Herb's desk, rather than the torn-up squares, which were still at Herb's flat anyway.
"Sorry," she said, "I don't recognise the stamp, but I know it's not ours."
"Can you tell who sent the money?" I asked.
"No," she said.
"What do you need to produce in the way of identification to collect money from a money home transfer?"
"The recipient's name and the MTCN."
"What's that?"
"There," she said, pointing at the payment slip. "It's the money transfer control number."
"And that's all you need to collect the money?" I said. "No passport or driving licence?"
"Not unless it's been specially requested by the sender," she said. "Sometimes there's a question I have to ask and then you'd have to give the right answer. It's a bit like spies and such."
She smiled. "So in fact," I said, "you have no way of knowing who has sent the money or who has collected it. The recipient's name is on the slip." The recipient's name on the slip I had shown her was Butch Cassidy. The names on the others I had were Billy Kidd, Wyatt Earp, Jesse James, and Bill Cody.
That isn't his real name, I said.
No, she said, looking. I suppose not.
But it's their money. As long as they paid us our fee, it's not our business who they really are.
Does the amount make any difference? I asked.
Money Home's head office doesn't allow us to accept transfers of more than the equivalent of $10,000, as that breaks the money laundering rules. Other than that, the amount doesn't matter, although we here have a payout limit of £4,000 without prior notice, you know, so we can get in the cash.
Are your transfers always in cash? I asked.
Yeah, of course, she said. That's what we do. Cash transfers. Lots of the immigrant workers round here send cash home to their wives. Poles, mostly. And we do a special deal on transfers to Poland, up to £1,000 for just £20.
Overall, it wasn't very helpful. Herbert clearly set up a system that would be difficult, if not impossible, to unravel. From what I could tell from the lists and the Money Home payment slips, it was clear that he'd received large sums of cash from multiple sources. Money he must have then used to pay the monthly balances on 22 credit cards. Herb had collected $18,000 worth of pounds sterling only the previous week, 5,000 of it just the day before his death. Some of that cash must still be hidden somewhere. My problem was that while I had the statement showing the £94,000 outstanding, and as his executor and beneficiary, I was liable for the debt, I hadn't yet found the stash of readies to pay it. Claudia wasn't at home when I arrived back at 3:30. I tried her mobile, but it went straight to voicemail. I wandered round the house, wondering what had gone wrong with our relationship. I didn't really understand it. The sex that morning had been as good as ever, but Claudia had been uncharacteristically quiet during and afterwards, as if her mind had been elsewhere. I asked myself what I really wanted. Did I want to continue, or was it time to draw a line and move on? Did I love her enough? How much would I miss her if she left? Claudia and I had been together now for almost 6 years. I was 29 and she was 3 years my junior. Apart from my real concern about her weird paintings, I found the setup comfortable and fulfilling. And I was happy as things were. Was that the trouble? Did Claudia want something more from our relationship than I did? Did she perhaps now want that ring on her finger? Or maybe she had changed her view about children? But then surely she would have told me. I would have been delighted. So I concluded it had to be me that was the problem. Claudia must have tired of me. And perhaps there was someone else already lined up to take my place. It was the only conclusion that made any sense. I tried her mobile again, but as before, it went straight to voicemail. The house suddenly felt very empty, and I realized that I was lonely without Claudia here. I wandered round looking at familiar things as if it was the first time I'd seen them. I went up to Claudia's studio and looked at the painting she was working on, and also at two or three others leaned against the wall waiting for the paint to dry and harden. As always, they were dark, and to my eye, somewhat disturbed. One of them was full of bizarre flying monsters with bird-like bodies and human heads, each head with a huge open mouth full of fearsome-looking pointed teeth. I shuddered and covered the image with another painting, this one of several identical and very beautiful women all dressed in blue ball gowns. A pretty enough sight, one might think, except these women had feet that were, in fact, eagle claws ripping apart the naked body of the man on whom they were standing. Was the man meant to be me? And were the women all representations of Claudia herself? Was this how our relationship would end, with Claudia ripping me apart? I doubted it would happen quite so literally as in the picture, but emotionally she had me halfway to the funny farm already. Once again I asked myself how such a sweet girl could paint such strange images, and I was sure they had become more bizarre and much more violent in recent months. Was there a whole side to Claudia's character that I remain totally unaware of? But on the whole, I believe that it was better for her to find an outlet for such strange thoughts than to keep them bottled up inside her head, with the pressure ever building towards explosive levels. The house phone rang, and I went through to our bedroom to answer it, hoping it would be Claudia. It wasn't. It was Patrick.
"I'm sorry for Gregory's outburst earlier," he said. "He and I had a discussion, and he's now calmed down a lot. He was just upset by what had been written in the papers."
Not as upset as me, I thought.
"So can I come back into the office?" I asked.
"Not today,"
he said rather too quickly,
Maybe on Monday or later next week. Let the dust settle for a few days. I'll work from home then, I said, using the remote access facility.
Right, Patrick said slowly, but I agreed with Gregory that you would not be representing the firm for the immediate future.
And how long exactly is the immediate future? I asked.
Until he and I agree, he said.
Are you telling me I'm fired?
No, of course not, he said. Just that it might be better for you to take some paid holiday until the police sort out who really did try to murder Billy Searle.
What if they never do? I asked.
Let's hope that is not the case, he said. I'll call you next week. In the meantime, I must ask you not to use the remote access facility and not to contact anyone at the firm.
Patrick disconnected without saying goodbye, no doubt pleased to have got through the conversation without me shouting at him. I felt like shouting at someone. Everything that had been fine just a week ago was suddenly going down the tubes. I sat down on the edge of the bed feeling more miserable than I had since the day I'd been told I couldn't ride again. I decided that feeling sorry for myself wasn't going to achieve anything, so I went downstairs and sat down at the kitchen table with my laptop computer. I spent a fairly unproductive half hour looking at the 6 emails that I had forwarded to my inbox from Gregory's concerning the Bulgarian property development. They were all from the same man, Yuri Yoram, and the first two were about the grants available to disadvantaged parts of the European Union for industrial developments that would assist in the regeneration of sites previously occupied by state-subsidized factories. Many such factories had quickly gone bust when the communist regime had collapsed, and free market competition had arrived in its place. As far as I could make out from Mr. Yoram's rather poor grasp of written English, the EU money would only be forthcoming if there was some private investment in the project on the basis that 2 euros would be granted for each 1 euro invested privately. Jolyon Roberts had told me that his family trust had invested £5 million, so that alone could have attracted a further £10 million from the European tax coffers. But that was not all. Not by a long way. The 4 remaining emails were about funding for the homes to be constructed close to the factory to house the workers. This was to come from a different source, the EU Social Housing Fund, and required no similar 2-for-1 arrangement. It appeared that the new factory alone was sufficient to trigger the 100% grant for the housing, which was in the region of €80 million. If, as Jolyon Roberts' nephew had implied, no houses and no factory had been built in Bulgaria, then someone somewhere had likely pocketed nearly €100 million, most of it public money. I looked closely at the email addresses. The emails had been sent by yuri_yoram@ec.europa.eu to dimitar.petrov@bsnet.co.bg, with Gregory Black being copied in. The ec.europa.eu domain indicated that Yuri Yoram worked in the offices of the European Commission, probably in Brussels, and I could deduce that Mr. Petrov must be in Bulgaria from the .bg extension. It wasn't a huge help. I also looked at the telephone number I had copied from the Roberts Family Trust file on Gregory's computer. I wondered if I should call it. But what good would it do? I couldn't speak Bulgarian, and even if whoever answered could understand English, they were most unlikely to give me any information that would answer my questions. What should I do? It may very well have been a simple mistake made by Mr. Roberts' nephew. He might have gone to the wrong place in Bulgaria with the factory and the houses existing elsewhere. Surely there would have been checks made by the European Union officials running the EU Social Housing Fund to confirm that their €80 million had been spent properly on bricks and mortar. I decided that, having been asked by Jolyon Roberts to look into it, I couldn't just do nothing. So I sent a short email to Dimitar Petrov asking him to send me the names and addresses of the directors of the Balscott Lighting Factory, if he had them. By the time I realized that sending the email was possibly not such a good idea if Mr. Petrov himself was one of those involved in the potential €100 million fraud, it was well on its way, and there was no bringing it back. It couldn't do any harm, could it? I closed my computer and looked at the clock. It was 4:45, so I made myself a cup of tea. I couldn't help but notice that Claudia had left her latest mobile phone bill lying on the worktop right next to the kettle, and I also couldn't resist the temptation to look at it. I suppose I was looking for numbers I didn't recognize that she had called regularly. There was one, with calls almost every day for the past 2 weeks, and often more than once a day. Now what did I do? Did I call the number and demand to know who had been talking so often to my girl? No, of course I didn't. But I copied the number into my mobile phone just in case I changed my mind. Claudia arrived home at 5:30, and I resisted the temptation to ask her where she had been and why her phone had been switched off. "Why aren't you at the office?" she asked.
"Patrick sent me home," I said. "Gregory seems to think I brought the company into disrepute. Patrick thinks it would be best for me to have some time off, to stay away from the office, just to let the dust settle."
"But that's ridiculous," she said. "The police let you go. You have a cast-iron alibi."
"I know that, and you know that," I replied crossly. "But you know what most people are like. They believe what they read."
"Those bloody newspapers," she said with feeling. "They shouldn't be allowed to give out people's names before they're charged."
Or even convicted, I thought. But I also knew the police were secretly quite keen for the names of those accused to be released early so that potential witnesses would come forward. "Patrick says it will all blow over in a few days," I said. "He thinks people will forget."
"I hope he's right," she said.
So did I.
"Did you get your dress?" I asked. "What dress?" she said.
"Come on, darling," I said, slightly irritated. "You know, the one you were going to buy for the opening night on Wednesday."
"Oh, that," she said, clearly distracted. "Perhaps I'll go tomorrow. Something came up this afternoon."
I didn't like to think what, so I didn't ask.
"How long did Patrick say you had to stay away from the office?" Claudia asked into the silence.
"Maybe a week," I said, wondering if she was asking for reasons other than worries over my reputation and career. "Perhaps I'll go to the races instead."
"Great idea," she said. "Give your mind a rest from all those figures."
Perhaps it was time to start looking at figures of a different kind.
Chapter 9. On Saturday afternoon, I put on my thick skin and went to Sandown Park Races on the train from Waterloo.
"Bloody hell," said Jan Setter. "I didn't expect to see you here. I thought you'd been sent to the Tower."
"Not quite," I said. I was standing on the grass close to the parade ring near the statue of the horse Special Cargo. "Did you do it?" Jan asked in all seriousness. "No, of course I didn't," I said. "The police wouldn't have let me go if they still thought I'd tried to kill Billy. I have an alibi."
"Then who did do it?"
"I don't know," I said, "but it wasn't me."
"Blimey," she said. "Then there's still a would-be murderer out there on the loose."
"Lots of them," I said. "Not just Billy's, but Herb Kovacs too."
"Who's Herb Kovac?" she asked.
"Chap who was shot at Aintree last Saturday," I said. "He was a colleague of mine at work."
"Did you kill him then?"
"Anne," I said forcefully, "I didn't kill anyone or try to, okay?"
"Then why were you arrested?"
I sighed. "People, even good friends, really did believe what they read in the papers. Someone told the police that Billy had shouted at me at Cheltenham, demanding to know why I was going to murder him. They put two and two together and made five. That's all. They got it wrong."
"So why did Billy shout at you?"
"It was to do with his investments," I said. Jan raised a questioning eyebrow. "It's confidential," I said. "You wouldn't want me telling everyone about your investments now, would you?"
"No," she agreed. "But then I haven't been deliberately knocked off my bike."
"That's a fair point, but confidentiality rules still apply," I said. "Severely injured or not, he's still my client."
Mind you, I thought, there was a limit to confidentiality.
The Wiltshire police had called me on Friday evening to make an appointment, and I had spent time with two of their number earlier, going over in minute detail all the events of Tuesday and Wednesday at Cheltenham races, with particular reference to Billy Searle's investments.
"Was it true that you owe Mr. Searle over £100,000?
One of them had asked me as his opening shot. "No," I replied calmly.
Not personally. I'm a financial advisor, and Billy Searle is a client of mine, which means I manage the investment of his money. In total, he has about $150,000 invested through me, and he told me on Tuesday that he urgently wanted all his money out in cash. He became very distressed and angry when I told him it would take a few days to realize the cash through the sale of his stocks and shares. "Why do you think Mr. Searle needed such a large sum so quickly?" the other policeman had asked. "He told me he owed some guy $100,000 and he needed to pay it back by Wednesday night at the very latest, or else."
"Or else what?"
they both asked in unison. Billy seemed frightened, and when I told him that his money wouldn't be in his bank until Friday, he said he hoped he would still be alive by Friday. Those were his exact words?
"Pretty much," I'd said.
"Did he give you any indication who this guy was?"
"None, but he was clearly terrified of him."
"Why don't you ask Billy?"
"Mr. Searle is in a critical condition," one of them had replied. "He has severe head injuries, and it is far from certain yet whether he will ever recover consciousness."
How dreadful, I thought. Billy had survived all those racing falls over all those years, only to have head injuries due to someone knocking him off his bike. It didn't seem fair.
"I wouldn't have thought that knocking someone off their bicycle was a very sure way of killing them," I'd said. "How would someone know he would be riding his bike at that time?"
"Well, Mr. Searle rode his bicycle to Lambourne every day at the same time. Apparently it was part of his fitness regime, and well known. And the car seems to have struck him with considerable force."
"Yes, but even so, it's not as certain as a shooting."
I had been thinking of Herb the previous Saturday. "Are you sure it was attempted murder?"
"We are treating the attack as attempted murder," one of them had replied, rather unhelpfully.
"Yes," I thought, "but that didn't necessarily make it so." "Can we go back to this man to whom Mr. Searle owed money? Are you sure that Mr. Searle gave you no indication who it was?"
"Positive," I'd said.
"All Billy told me was that he owed the money to some guy." "But why would you try to kill someone because they owed you money? Then there would be no chance of getting it back. Maybe the attack had been meant as a warning or a reminder to pay up and had simply gone too far. Or had it been a message to others, pay up or else, just as Billy had been afraid of? The Racing Post seems to have implied that it was a bookmaker."
"I think that was probably speculation on their part," I'd said. "Billy never mentioned anything like that to me. In fact, he said that he couldn't tell me why he owed the money."
"So why did he claim that it was you who was murdering him?"
"I now realize that he must have believed he might be murdered because I couldn't get his money together by Wednesday night, and it would therefore be my fault if he was killed, but obviously I didn't think that at the time."
The two policemen had then effectively asked me the same questions over and over again in slightly different ways, and I had answered them each time identically, with patience and good grace. Eventually, after more than an hour, they had been satisfied that I had nothing else to tell them, and had gone away, but not before they'd had a close inspection of my car to see if there were any dents or scratches caused by Billy Searle's bicycle. So much for my alibi. As soon as they had gone, I had rushed away from home, just making it to Sandown in time for the first race. I'd had to endure a few stares on my way into the race course, together with a few indelicate and abusive comments, but even so, it felt good to be in a familiar environment, as well as free in the fresh air. It would have been better still if I'd been riding.
"Do you have any runners today?" I asked Jan. At least I could be certain that this time she hadn't come to the races just to see me.
"One in the big chase," she said. "Ed's Charger. Not much chance, but the owner insisted." She rolled her eyes up into her head, and I laughed. "Still got your sense of humour, then?"
"Why shouldn't I have?" I asked.
"Seems everyone you talk to gets themselves murdered or attacked."
"I hope it doesn't happen to me."
So did I. She might have indeed been just about old enough to be my mother, but she was still a very attractive woman. Had I been a tad too hasty, I wondered, in turning down her offer? Jan went into the weighing room to find the jockey who was riding her horse, while I leaned on the rail of the paddock and looked up Ed's Charger in the race card. I noticed It was to be written by Mark Vickers, my client, and now, with Billy Searle out of the running, the champion jockey in waiting. Billy's attempted murder had certainly been convenient for Mark's championship ambitions, but I didn't really believe that the attack in Baden had been arranged for that purpose. True, there had been the infamous incident when one Olympic ice skater had allegedly arranged for the leg of her rival to be broken so as to better her own chances. But attempted murder was surely a step too far, if indeed that was what it had been. And there was the unanswered question of the £100,000 and, in particular, to whom it had been owed by Billy and why.
"Hi, Foxy! Penny for your thoughts," said a voice behind me,
and I groaned inwardly. Martin Gifford was the last person I wanted to see. I turned round and forced a smile at him. "Just working on my next murder," I said. "Do you fancy being the victim?" Martin looked really worried for a fraction of a second before he realized I was joking.
"Very funny," he said, regaining his composure. "Tell me, what was it like being arrested?"
"A laugh a minute," I said. "And you didn't bloody help by telling the Post you thought I knew more about the Aintree killing than I was letting on. And why did you tell them that Herb Kovac was my best friend when I specifically told you he was only a work colleague?"
"I only told them what I believed to be true," he said self-righteously.
"Bastard," I said. "You made it all up, and you know it."
"Now, come on, Foxy," he said. "You weren't being completely honest with me? The truth, remember? The whole truth and nothing but the truth?" "Bollocks," I said forcefully. "We were not in court, and what makes you think you have a divine right to know everything about everybody anyway? You're the most indiscreet man on a race course. You couldn't keep a secret if your life depended on it."
I knew as soon as I'd said it that it had been a mistake. Martin Gifford was all I'd said he was, but he was also the sort of person one needed to keep on one side, and I probably just lost him as an ally forever. But I didn't care. I'd had my fill of him over the years, and I looked forward to him not coming up every time he saw me and offering me a penny for my thoughts.
"Well, if that's what you think," he said haughtily, "you can bugger off."
And with that, he turned and walked away with his nose held high. It had been a fairly weak riposte, but no less accurate for that. Jan came back out of the weighing room and over the grass to where I was standing. I watched her walk towards me with slightly renewed interest. She saw me looking at her and wiggled her hips. "Changed your mind then, lover boy?" she said quietly as she came up close to me. "No," I said. "But had I?" "Pity," she replied. "Are you sure you won't come over to my place for a ride?" "I told you I couldn't. I can't take the chance with my neck." "Not that sort of ride, silly," she smiled. "I'd give you a ride where it wouldn't be your neck that would have to take its chances." She leaned forward suggestively over the paddock rail, rubbing her bottom up against my leg. "Jan, behave yourself," I said. "Why should I?" she asked, laughing. "I'm a rich divorcee, remember? By definition, we're not meant to behave ourselves." "Fancy a fuck."
"Jan," I said, "please stop it."
"My," she said abruptly, standing bolt upright next to me, "I do believe you're embarrassed. What an old-fashioned strange boy you are." I was certainly old-fashioned, but was I really strange? Maybe I was, but did that mean I wanted Jan as a lover? No, I suddenly decided, it did not. I wanted Claudia. My real reason for coming to Sandown had been to see Jolyon Roberts. According to the morning paper, one of the horses running in the third race was owned by Viscount Shennington, and I hoped it was one of those he co-owned with his brother. I looked out for Colonel Roberts on the grandstand during the first and second races, but unsurprisingly, I couldn't see him. The fine weather had helped to bring out a good Saturday crowd at Sandown for one of the very few mixed meetings of the year. That is where both flat and jumping contests were scheduled side by side on the 8-race card. Indeed, the first race of the day was a special 1-mile flat race where jockeys from both codes raced against each other in a sort of flat versus jumping championship. I went down to the parade ring before the third race, and sure enough, Jolyon Roberts was there, standing on the grass in the centre with a group of 3 other men and 2 ladies, none of whom I recognised. I manoeuvred myself next to a gap in the rails, through which I assumed the Roberts party would eventually need to pass, and waited. He saw me when he was about 5 strides away, and if he was shocked or surprised, he didn't show it. However, I did detect a very slight shake of the head as he looked me square in the eye. As a true gentleman, he stepped to the side to allow the others in his party to pass through the exit first. Chase's bar, after the sixth, Jolyon Robert said quietly but distinctly, and straight at me as he went through the gap, not breaking his guard's step. I stood still and watched as he caught up one of the ladies and took her arm. He didn't look back at me. His words may have been softly spoken, but his message had been crystal clear. Don't stop me now. I'll speak with you later in private. I was in the Chasers' bar well ahead of him. In fact, I watched the sixth race on one of the wall-mounted television sets so as to ensure I could get a table discreetly situated in the corner furthest from the door and away from the bar. I sat watching the entrance with two glasses of wine in front of me, one red and one white. Jolyon Roberts appeared, stopped briefly to look around, then strode purposefully over and sat down opposite me. "Sorry about this, sir," I said, "but I had no other way of contacting you." "What do you have to tell me?" he said. "Drink?" I asked, indicating the wine. "No, thank you," he said. "I don't. Never have." "Something soft?" I asked. "No, nothing, thank you." "What a shame about your horse," I said. "It had fallen at the second hurdle and broken a leg."
"These things happen," he said. "My wife was more upset about it than me. To be honest, it solved the problem of what to do with the damn thing. It couldn't have won the race if it started yesterday."
He chuckled loudly at his own joke, a habit I found slightly irritating.
"Now, tell me what you found."
"Nothing much, I'm afraid," I said, taking a large sip of the white wine, "except that if it is a fraud, it's a much bigger fraud than either of us thought."
"In what way?" he asked.
"The factory project would seem to be only the key to a much bigger enterprise," I said. "The factory was to have cost about 20 million euros, with your family trust putting in just over 6 million and getting European Union funding at the rate of 2 euros for each one of yours." He nodded. "That's right," he said. "It was about 5 million pounds." "Yes," I said. "But it was the funding of the factory that triggered the grant for the housing project. And that was a whopping 80 million euros, without the need for any further private finance. So it was your investment that was the key to it all." I paused. "How did you hear about the investment opportunity in the first place?"
"I can't really remember," he said, "but it must have been through Gregory Black. Almost everything the trust invests in, other than the family estate, is done through Lyle and
Black." "So was the naming of the factory Gregory Black's idea?"
"Oh, I can't remember," he said. "What does it matter? The important thing is whether or not the factory exists. That's what I'm most concerned about."
"I haven't yet managed to find that out. Is there any chance I could speak with your nephew?" Mr. Roberts looked doubtful. "I'd just like to ask him where he went and what he saw, or not, as the case may be."
"He's up at Oxford," he said.
"Oxford University?" I asked. Jolyon Roberts nodded. "At Keble, reading PPE. Thinks he wants to change the world. Bit full of himself, if you ask me." PPE was philosophy, politics, and economics. I'd thought of applying for it myself, but had opted instead for a degree course at the LSE. PPE at Oxford was often seen as the first step on the political ladder to real power, both in British and foreign governments and elsewhere. Alumni included such diverse members as three UK prime ministers, including David Cameron, the Nobel Peace Prize-winning Burmese pro-democracy campaigner Aung San Suu Kyi, the media tycoon Rupert Murdoch, and the convicted IRA bomber Rose Dugdale. Even Bill Clinton had studied with the Oxford PPE class for a while when he was at the university as a Rhodes Scholar. If Jolyon Roberts' nephew wanted to change the world, he was starting at the right place. "Do you have a telephone number for him?" I asked. Jolyon Roberts seemed rather hesitant.
"Look," he said, "I'd much rather he wasn't involved."
"But, sir," I said, "he is involved. You told me he was the one who started your concerns in the first place by visiting Bulgaria."
"Yes," he said, "but my brother, his father,
has told him to forget it." "Does your brother have any idea you have spoken to me?"
"Good God, no," replied Mr. Roberts. "He'd be furious."
"Sir," I said formally, "I think it might be best if I left you to sort out any further questions you might have with Gregory himself. I have rather gone out on a limb here to find out the small amount I have, but I think it's time to stop. The Roberts Family Trust is our client in this matter, and your brother is the senior trustee. I really should not act behind his back." Nor behind Gregory's, I thought.
No, he said. Quite right, I can see that. He paused. Sorry, should have realized. I'll give Gregory Black a call about it on Monday. He paused again. Right, matter closed as far as you're concerned. I'll trouble you no further.
He stood up, nodded at me briefly, and walked out of the bar. I sat there for a while longer and transferred my allegiance from white wine to red. Had I done the right thing? Definitely. I was a financial advisor, not a fraud investigator. But what if there really was a 100 million euro fraud going on? Had I not a responsibility to report it to someone, but to whom? Perhaps I should send an email to Yuri Yorum at the European Commission. But did I care? I finished the red wine and decided it was time to head home. Going home to Claudia had always filled me with excitement, raising the pulse a fraction and causing things to stir down below. But now I was hesitant, even frightened, of what I might find, of what I might hear, of what I might see. Claudia was at home when I arrived back, and she'd been crying. She tried to hide it from me, but I could always tell. The slight redness of the eyes and the streaky mascara were dead giveaways.
You could have phoned me, she said crossly as I walked into the kitchen. You should know better than to sneak up on a girl.
I'd hardly sneaked up, I thought. This was my home, and I was arriving back from the races at 6:30 on a Saturday evening.
You can't phone on the tube, I said.
You could have phoned on the train from Sandown.
That was true. But the reason I hadn't was because I didn't want my call to go straight to voicemail again. That alone sent my imagination into overdrive. It was much better not to know if Claudia's phone was turned off. Now, darling, what's the matter? I said, putting an arm round her shoulders.
Nothing, she said, shrugging me off. Just my back hurts. I'm going up to have a bath.
She walked briskly out of the kitchen, leaving me standing there alone. She had complained of backache a lot recently. Probably from too much lying on it, I thought, somewhat ungraciously. I mixed myself a large, strong gin and tonic. Not really a great idea after two glasses of wine at Sandown, but who cares? I wasn't trying to make a riding weight for the next day's racing. More's the pity. I could hear her bath running upstairs. And quite suddenly I was cross. Did she think I was a fool? Something was definitely not right in this household, and painful as it might be, I had a right to know. I thought about charging upstairs and confronting her in the bathroom, but I was frightened. I didn't want to lose her, and I'm not sure I could bear it if she said she was leaving me for someone else. I walked through into the sitting room and flicked on the television, but I didn't watch it. Instead, I sat in an armchair feeling miserable and drank my gin. In due course, I heard the bathwater drain away, and presently Claudia came downstairs and went into the kitchen, closing the door. I really didn't know what to do. Did she want me to go in to her or not? Not, I thought, or she would have left the door open. I stayed where I was in the sitting room and finished my drink. According to the clock on the mantelpiece, it was 7:20. Was it too early to go to bed? I sat in the armchair while some teenage stick insect warbled away on the screen in a TV talent show, going over and over in my head what I needed to say to Claudia. Doing nothing was no longer an option. If our relationship was dead, so be it. Let me mourn. Anything was better than remaining in this state of limbo with my imagination running wild and my emotions in turmoil. I loved Claudia, I was sure of it. But here I was, angry and hurt, accusing her in my mind of deceiving me and sleeping with another. It was time for the truth. When I walked into the kitchen, she was crying openly, and with no pretense this time that she wasn't. She was sitting at the kitchen table in her blue toweling dressing gown, her elbows on the table, a glass of white wine in one hand, and her head in the other. She didn't look up as I went in. At least, I thought, she's not leaving me with a dismissive wave of the hand and not a single glance back. This breakup was going to be painful for both of us. I went over to the worktop beside the fridge and poured myself another stiff gin and tonic. I was going to need it. Darling, what's the matter? I said, but without turning round. Perhaps it would be easier for her to talk if she couldn't see my face.
Oh, Nick,
she said, her voice quivering slightly.
There's something I have to tell you, she gulped. And you're not going to like it.
I turned around to face her. Maybe I didn't want to make it too easy for her after all. She looked up at me.
I'm so sorry, she said.
I could feel the tears welling up in my own eyes. All I wanted to do was to hug her.
I'm so sorry, she said again. I've got cancer.
Chapter 10. How could I have been so wrong? And so stupid. What? I said.
Cancer, she repeated. I've got ovarian cancer.
How? I said foolishly. I mean, when?
I've sort of known for about 2 weeks, but I found out for certain on Thursday. So why didn't you tell me? I asked. I was going to, but to start with, you were so busy at work, and I was going to tell you on the night of the Grand National, but there was all that Herb Kovac business. I thought you had enough of your own troubles. Then on Thursday, she gulped. Thursday was an awful day. When I left the hospital after the doctor confirmed everything, I was sort of numb, couldn't feel anything, didn't even know where I was going.
She paused and wiped a tear from her cheek with the sleeve of her dressing gown.
It was while I was walking aimlessly down Tottenham Court Road that Rosemary called to tell me you'd been arrested. It was all dreadful. Then you were so angry at having your name in the papers that somehow I couldn't tell you that night, and, well, yesterday seemed so fraught between us, and I thought it best to leave it because you had so much else on.
You silly, gorgeous girl, I said. Nothing is more important to me than you. I went round behind her and put my hands on her shoulders and rubbed them.
So what do we do now? I asked. I've got to have an operation on Tuesday.
Oh, I said. Suddenly this was very real and very urgent. What are they going to do?
Remove my left ovary, she said, choking back more tears. And they might have to remove them both. Then I'll never be able to have a baby.
Oh, I thought, too real and too urgent.
And I know how much you want to have children, Claudia said. I'm so sorry.
The tears flowed freely again. Now, now, I said, stroking her back, your current health is far more important than any future children. You always said children were troublesome anyway.
I've been desperate, she said. I thought you'd be so cross.
Don't be so silly. The only thing I'm cross about is that you didn't tell me straight away. It must have been dreadful for you, bottling it all up with no one to talk to.
My doctor has been wonderful, she said. He gave me the name of a cancer counsellor.
She produced a crumpled business card from the pocket of her dressing gown.
And she's been an absolute rock. I've called her so many times now, I know her number by heart.
I looked at the business card. The number was the much-called one I had copied from her mobile phone bill. How, I asked myself again, could I have got things so wrong? Tell me, I said, what did the doctor say?
I first went to my GP because I didn't feel very well and I could feel that my tummy was bloated. She smiled. I actually thought I might be pregnant, but I'm on the pill and I'd just had my period.
And? I prompted.
He asked me if I had any back pain and I said yes. So he sent me to see a cancer specialist who did some scans and other tests and they came back positive.
Back pain. I inwardly chastised myself for my earlier thoughts.
So what is actually wrong with your ovaries? I asked. I have a tumour in the left one, she said. It's what is apparently called a germ cell tumour.
Is it malignant? I asked, dreading the answer.
Yes, I'm afraid it is, she said. But it's fairly small, about the size of a peanut.
That didn't sound that small to me. I thought whole ovaries themselves were not much bigger than that.
And the oncologist is hopeful that it hasn't spread, but he will find out for sure about that on Tuesday.
Where are you having the op? I asked.
University College Hospital, she said. It's where I've been seeing the oncologist and having tests all this last week. I was there most of the day yesterday having MRI scans, so they know exactly to the millimeter where the cancer is and how big, ready for the operation.
With her phone turned off.
Overall, I've been lucky they found it so soon.
Apparently, it's quite usual for such tumours to go undetected until it's too late, because many GPs dismiss the symptoms or confuse them with other problems.
What can I do to help? I asked.
Nothing, she said. Just be here.
She smiled.
I love you so much.
I felt a fool and a charlatan. How could I have been so stupid? I love you so much more, I said, kissing the top of her head. Do you need to go to bed?
I'm not feeling ill, she said, turning and looking up at me with a smile. Or were you thinking of something else?
I blushed. It must have been the gin.
I wasn't, I said. However, I could be persuaded. But, I mean, are you all right? For sex, she said. I nodded. Absolutely. The oncologist told me on Thursday that it wouldn't make any difference.
It made a difference to me. I lay awake in the dark of the small hours trying to get my head round this new problem. I had feared so much the thought of losing her to another man that the news of the cancer had almost been a relief, a reprieve. But this was now a much more serious battle with the unthinkable outcome of losing her altogether if the fight was lost. Claudia had gone to sleep around 10 o'clock, and I had then spent the next couple of hours at my computer researching ovarian cancer on the internet. My initial results had been far from encouraging. Overall, ovarian cancer 5-year survival rates were only about 50%. That was not good, I thought. It was like tossing a coin. To live, you had to correctly call heads. However, Claudia had said that the oncologist thought that the cancer hadn't spread. For stage 1A ovarian cancers, those that were confined within the affected organ and which hadn't spread to its surface, the survival rate was nearly 92%. That was better. Throw 2 dice, score 11 or 12, and you die. Anything else, you live. For germ cell cancer, the rates were even better. Women with only stage 1A germ cell tumours had a near 97% chance of survival at 5 years. Throw those dice again. You are dead now only with a double 6, slightly worse than the statistical survival rate for a space shuttle flight, 98%. Much better than for a heart transplant, 71% at 5 years. I could hear Claudia's rhythmic breathing on the pillow next to me. Funny, I thought, how it often takes a crisis to reveal one's true feelings. Since coming home from the races, I had been through the whole gamut, from resentful anger to perilous joy, with apprehension, fear, and overwhelming love coming in late on the side. I was exhausted by it all, but still I couldn't sleep. How close had I come to making a complete fool of myself? Too close. Much too close. Sunday morning dawned bright and sunny, both in terms of the weather and my disposition. I looked at Claudia soundly asleep beside me, and in spite of the uncertainty of her future treatment, I thanked my lucky stars. True, I had been tempted by Jan's extraordinary behaviour, but I had resisted. In fact, it had been Jan's very behaviour that had strengthened my resolve to sort out a problem with Claudia that, in the end, hadn't existed. Suddenly, the other problem, the coming battle against the cancer, while not easy, somehow seems now manageable, especially as Claudia and I would both be fighting on the same side. I got up quietly, leaving her sleeping, and went downstairs to the kitchen and to my computer. I pulled up the emails from Yuri Yoram onto the screen and read them again. I wondered what I should do about them. €100 million was an awful lot of money, but it was a mere drop in the ocean compared to the European Union total budget of more than €125 billion. But if the European Court of Auditors, the body that had refused to sign off the annual audit of the EU budget for each of the past umpteen years, had themselves been unable to make a single major fraud charge stick, what chance did I have? I decided that it simply wasn't my fight. Claudia and I now had more pressing things on our minds. If Jolyon Roberts needed to ask any further questions about his investments, then he'd have to speak directly to Gregory. I, meanwhile, turned to other matters, in particular the copies of the statements from Herb's 22 credit cards. I sorted them into date order and noticed that 4 of them were due for payment in the coming week. I wondered what the law was on outstanding credit card debt at death.
One thing I was absolutely certain about was that none of the banks would, out of the kindness of their hearts, cancel their debt. But it was the interest that I was most concerned about. £94,626.52 would, if left unpaid, attract a substantial interest charge each month, not to mention late payment fees. And it might take many months before probate was granted, and I was able to pay off the debts from other assets in Herb's estate. I had to find the cash. Even the £18,000 he collected from the Money Home agents the week of his death would not be enough to pay off the four most urgent ones. And that would not be all. The 97 separate individuals who were using Herb's accounts for their internet gambling and casino playing probably didn't know Herb was dead. If their past form was anything to go by, they would be racking up further charges. All gambling requires a degree of trust, but surely Herb must have required an upfront cash advance from each of the 97 in order to allow them to operate the system. That meant the debt of £94,626.52 that existed on the credit card statements may only have been the start of it. How much more did he owe? I had to find the cash. I decided that the very first thing I had to do was to cancel the cards so that no more charges could be made on them. Each of the statements had a phone number on the back, and I set about calling them. Many of them did not answer because they were not open on Sundays, and those that did were mostly in India and, in truth, could have been more helpful. As soon as I said that Mr. Kovac was dead, they all required me to contact them in writing, enclosing an original death certificate. "Fine," I said to one man called Ashwin, making a mental note to ask the police chief inspector for 22 originals of Herb's death certificate. "But could you in the meantime make a stop on any future charges?" "Cut up the cards," Ashwin said, "and then there can't be any more charges, can there?" How, I wondered, should I explain to him that the cards themselves hadn't actually been present when any of the charges on the statements had been made? "There are some regular payments," I said, "where the card is not actually present for the transaction. Can't you stop those?"
"You will have to contact the payee," he said unhelpfully.
All 512 of them, I thought. Next, I tried impersonating Herb to cancel one card, but this didn't work either, as I didn't have the card. It was in Hendon, and I had no idea of the expiry date or the PIN number. Anyway, I was firmly told, I couldn't cancel a card until I paid off the outstanding balance. Dead end. I just had to find that cash. Claudia came downstairs in her blue dressing gown.
"What are you doing?" she asked.
"Oh, nothing," I said, closing the lid of my laptop onto the credit card statements. "Nothing for you to worry about, anyway."
"Look here," she said, putting on a stern face. "I told you my troubles, so now you have to tell me yours."
"It's just something to do with Herb Kovac," I said. "In his will, he appointed me as his executor."
"And what does that mean, exactly?" she asked.
"It means," I said, "that I have to sort out all his bloody affairs when I should be looking after you."
"Quite right," she said, coming over and sitting on my lap. She put her arms round my neck.
"Naughty boy," I smiled. Life was back to normal. Or almost. During the afternoon, I called Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson on the mobile number he had given me.
"Hello?"
a voice said, sounding sleepy. "Chief Inspector Tomlinson?" I asked.
"Oh, yes,"
he said, this time more alert. "Sorry to wake you," I said. "This is Nicholas Foxton."
"Just resting my eyes,"
he said. "How can I help you?" "I think it's me who's going to help you," I said. "Herb Kovac's sister has turned up."
"Really?"
he said.
"When?"
"Well, actually, on Thursday morning, not long after you'd left his flat. But so much has been happening since then that I forgot to tell you."
"Yes," he said. "I did hear that you've been kept rather busy."
"Yes," I agreed. "Thank you for giving me an alibi."
"You don't have to thank me," he said. "I simply told them that there was no way, short of using a helicopter, that anyone could travel the 70 miles from Baden to Hendon in 55 minutes at that time of day, especially someone who just had an ingrowing toenail removed. I could hardly walk with mine for weeks."
I stifled a laugh. Good old Mrs. McDowd and her fertile imagination.
"Well, thank you, nevertheless,"
I said. "Now, I have some other information for you."
"Yes?"
he said. "I think I may have solved the riddle of the credit cards."
"Go on,"
he said.
I think that Herb Kovac was allowing other people to use his credit card accounts to gamble on the internet, probably fellow Americans, because it's illegal to gamble in most states over there.
What evidence do you have?
He asked. Not much, I said, but I think I'm right. There are 512 different entries on those statements, but there aren't 512 different individuals, because many of them bet or play on more than one internet site.
Do you have any idea who these people are?
No, I said. But we do have 97 different sets of initials. They're on those sheets you showed me. I think they refer to 97 different people.
So you're saying that you think 97 different people...